Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and tech that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Our first guest today is Allie Wilkinson. She's a freelance journalist who writes for the likes of National Geographic News, Scientific American, Discover, Popular Science, Slate, and Popular Mechanics, along with others. She recently wrote an article about the best road trips for discovering cool science. Stay with us and we'll find out where those top spots are.
Good morning, Lynn. And then our knowledge of biology, psychology, artificial intelligence, fluid mechanics, and robotics is in part helped out by research done on something you probably never expect, the octopus. It's interdisciplinary science, and it's what our second guest, Frank Grasso, will talk about.
And finally, you know him as our local Summit County Council person, but Chris Robinson's interests reach far beyond that. He's a conservationist and one who just won a Division of Wildlife Resources award for his work done on sage-grouse habitat. He'll join us in the last part of the hour.
You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with John Wells. Our guest, Allie Wilkinson, can tell you what to do with your summer as a freelance journalist for publications like Discover, Scientific American, Popular Science, and others. She spends time with the cool science stories, and those she finds most interesting, she turns into a road trip. That sounds like fun. We'll hear about some of the top places she has chosen and also what are her favorite science and tech stories that she's encountered this year. Allie Wilkinson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you write for a variety of really great publications. You're constantly looking for science and tech stories. And so I'm wondering, you know, other than what your editors telling you to do, how do you identify something in science or technology that appeals to you that you also know will appeal to the rest of us folks out here?
Predominantly, I like to cover the areas that my scientific background is in. And so whenever there's something really big and important in environmental science or conservation biology, that's something that I immediately want to cover. And I think a lot of people are interested in wildlife. And then I've found myself covering more technology, even though that's not my background, because I've found all these projects that have just made me think, wow, that sounds really cool. One of my first stories was actually for a molecular biology laboratory that's out in the ocean, and the new model is going to be attached to an autonomous underwater vehicle that the scientists can either chart a route for it, or it has sensors and it can respond to environmental cues like pigments from harmful algal blooms. And so anything like that where I think, wow, that's really sort of unique and innovative, those are other things that I like to write about. And I think appeal to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of going beyond that, determining how the application is going to further science and technology or how the innovation will be applied in either one foray or a variety.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds great. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about these. You co-wrote this article, I believe, with some others, but you picked some top spots that if you want to go on a road trip this summer and you like science, where you might end up. And they're very interesting because they're very diverse. But let's start with Key Largo.
Okay. So the Key Largo piece was actually written by another writer. It focuses on the Reef Environmental Education Foundation, and I'm familiar with this location and this organization. I had attended a marine biology camp in the Florida Keys, and we had actually participated in some of the reef fish surveys.
Oh, go ahead.
Key Largo is really accessible if you're coming from the Miami area. It's really a short drive, and it has beautiful reefs. Of course, corals have taken a toll worldwide because of climate change, and the Florida Keys, sometimes they do have ship groundings, but the work that Reef is doing really helps scientists gain a better understanding of what species are there, in what numbers, and it's a great opportunity to, you know, slip on your fins and get out in the water.
And if you don't scuba, can you also snorkel and have the same experience?
Yes. When I had done a reef survey, I actually had only been a snorkeler at the time.
Okay. Mm. And, you know, what is the current status of the world's reef system?
A lot of the reefs in the world are in trouble. As climate change gets worse, the oceans are acidifying, and it's just really, really stressful for the corals, which depend on symbiotic algae inside to photosynthesize and provide a lot of their nutrients. And when sea temperatures get too hot or too acidic, the algae called zooxanthellae sort of jump ship, or the corals can't build their hard protective shells.
Right.
So now you are traveling to Key Largo. You're in your minivan with, you know, you and your husband and your five kids or whatever, if you're from Utah. And you show up at Key Largo. How do you find and then become involved with helping scientists chart and find the 400 varieties of fish species there?
I think the best bet would be to contact Reef directly and check out their website. They do have trips organized, and they can also probably direct you to other scuba and snorkel outfitters in the area that might provide you with materials to do one of these fish surveys. When I had done it with my camp, we had a little waterproof fish guide and a dive slate, so you could sort of keep track as you were puttering around with your fins and snorkel.
That sounds so much fun. And then to also know you're actually being helpful and creating a scientific study while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of opportunities now for regular people to get involved in scientific studies and participate. And I think it's a really fun way to experience the world.
And do you have any idea of, you know, kids love to do summer internships and things like that. Are there any paid positions for the layperson?
At Reef in Key Largo or in general?
Just, well, in this area or any that you know of, maybe with Reef or maybe with any other organization?
I'm not sure if they have internships, but the marine science camp I had gone to was on Big Pine Key, and it's called Sea Camp. And they do have a lot of college kids who are counselors and help teach some of the classes.
Allie, before we go on to the next destination, I'm curious, how many candidates were there for destinations that you whittled down to four?
That actually is a question better answered by the editor. I just have pitched cool science destinations that I've found, and two of them had made it into this issue, and two were in upcoming issues.
Okay, and which ones were yours?
I had written about Mount Desert Island up in Maine and the Mesa Laboratory in Colorado.
Well, let's talk about one of yours then, Mount Desert Island. I have been out to Acadia National Park, and it's absolutely beautiful. Tell us why this was one of the four.
I've actually been going to Mount Desert Island every year as far as back as I can remember. It's been an annual family vacation destination, and there's just so much to do that I thought that it would really appeal to Discover readers. when I was a kid, one of the laboratories that I mentioned in the piece, the Mount Desert Island Biological Laboratory, used to have one day a week in the summer where the public could go and listen to a presentation and tour some of the facilities. And as a kid who just was in love with science, it was great to see the place where the action was happening. And in recent years, I've found out about the Jackson Laboratory, which is also up there. It's a huge name in biomedical science, and they also have tours for the public. But then outside of the labs, there's just a million things to do. You can go hiking and biking. They have kayaking, and you can see seals from your kayak and puffin cruises and whale watching. And it's a nature and wildlife lover's paradise.
Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful area. I was there probably last about 20 years ago, and this is before all the designer ice creams came out. And I remember a place right there had lobster ice cream, and I was like,
yes,
oh.
Yes, I've tried the lobster ice cream.
Have you? How was it?
It really just tasted like vanilla ice cream with little chunks of lobster meat in it. I don't think I would order an entire scoop, but it wasn't weird like you might expect it to be.
Yeah, I didn't try it. But I do remember one thing. I was with my family. We were on top of Cadillac Mountain, which is the highest peak in the east. And there was a vista point where you had this beautiful look into look down, I mean, across this beautiful horizon. And there was a picture from about, I think it was like 80 years ago, that was totally pollution-free. And then, of course, we were all looking out, and this was 20 years ago. It's probably gotten worse. And there was a haze on everything. And they were pointing out 20 years ago the big difference. And I don't know if you've ever seen that area.
Are you talking about Blue Hill Overlook, the sunset spot?
Yep, it's at the top of Cadillac.
Okay. The very top.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been out there. I haven't seen any historical photos to compare it to as a reference point.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite possible.
Yeah.
Well, Ellie, I'm wondering why Mount Desert Island is called that. When I think of Maine, I don't think of it as being a desert at all. Is there more than just the name?
Yes. It actually is closely related to the French name for it, which translated to Island of the Barren Mountains. And there are some sparse mountaintops that you can see from the water when French explorer Samuel de Champlain first saw the island, and so the name stuck.
Interesting. And so would you say that as a young kid, your parents exposed you, or was it just your own intrinsic desire to learn about biology and science? What kind of sharpened and whetted your motivation to learn about science?
Well, my very first best friend in kindergarten, Crystal Buckley, her dad was our school science teacher, and I think that that has had a profound impact on my life, because once a week we were having play dates where he would take us up to the science lab, and he would have us help him release wildlife he had rehabilitated. And that really sparked my interest in science, and my parents and my grandparents were very supportive of it, and they would take me to zoos and aquariums and museums, and I had science birthdays and went to science camps pretty much my entire childhood. So they took me to a lot of places where I could learn and explore and pursue that passion.
That's nice.
Did you receive popular science and popular mechanics when you were a kid?
As a kid, I actually read National Geographic the most.
Okay.
That was my big magazine and TV channel that I loved.
Well, let's go to your next location, the one that you picked out, Mesa Laboratory and Visitor Center, where the National Center for Atmospheric Research is conducted. That's a beautiful part of the world in Boulder, Colorado, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I haven't been out to Boulder, but I went to Denver a few years ago, and it's so different out there coming from New York. It's so beautiful.
And did you choose this similar to Mount Desert because of the tremendous variety of things that you could do out there?
Yes, that's actually one of the requirements for a hot science destination. It's not just a museum that you can go to, but there's a ton of offerings, so you could go on a week-long vacation and do something. And so I had my eyes peeled for different science institutions that did have offerings for the public. And I have friends who live in Boulder, and they just have such great things to say about it. And the more I researched it, it just sounds like a great place that you can go and you can get your science and you can learn about some of the work that they're doing. But like Acadia, there are so many outdoor options that it was hard to pick what to feature in the article.
Right. It's also educational. I think at National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCAR, you mentioned in the article that that they feature hands-on activities, workshops, presentations, those sorts of things. And going to their website, you can look at all the different things that they offer.
Mm-hmm. Places with hands-on components are always fun. I feel like a little kid when I go to those places because I want to be trying all those things as well.
And this is really helpful, Allie, because, you know, I've been to Boulder a number of times, and I've always seen that imposing structure up set against the mountains in Boulder. And I never imagined that you could go there as a visitor, nor that there would be hands-on things that you could do there. But this is great.
Yeah, it's actually surprising. The more I've done research on science destinations, the more places I realize do have these offerings for the public that, if you just happen to be in the area, yeah, you never would know. I had spent every year in Bar Harbor, and I never knew the Jackson Lab had tours until maybe 2 years ago.
How about that? And speaking of places you would never think that the public would be welcome in, let's talk a little bit about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation there in Washington. Now, this is out in eastern Washington by the Tri-Cities, Pasco and Kennewick, right? And it's out there kind of in the middle of I think of it as fields of, you know, agriculture out in that area. But there's this nuclear reactor that you can look down inside. So talk about that.
This is actually one of the pieces that surprised me the most, because I wouldn't have thought you could go to a nuclear reservation as well. It sounds like a really interesting place to go because they do have two different tour options, either looking at the deactivated B reactor or going on a bus tour throughout the facility and learning about the history. And I know that there are so many people out there who love history, and so I think a place like that, it would be fascinating to learn about it. And with two half-day tours, you might be able to fit both in the same day or go back twice.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say that a lot of people are very interested in the Manhattan Project, and the B reactor was a key piece to that in providing a lot of the plutonium that that went into those initial tests and initial bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I wanted to comment when we were talking about Bar Harbor that you didn't have the accent. Where's your Bar Harbor accent?
Oh, I'm from New York, but actually I seem to not have a New York accent or a Bar Harbor accent.
Yeah. Okay.
Working on that standard American English. That's what we're working on here,
right,
too, in Utah.
That's right. Allie, I'm curious, in the beginning of your article, where is that? Oh, it's right here. You say, tell us about your favorite science summer road trip at discovermagazine.com/destinations. What sort of feedback have you gotten from your readers?
Again, that would be another question best answered by the magazine. As a freelancer, I have a very busy schedule, and so I'm not always able to go back in and check on the feedback afterwards.
I wonder what they may have come up with, but, you know, the readers to Discover probably had some pretty good ideas. So we'll have to check that out. Maybe they'll publish that in a future Discover article.
I could imagine that most of the larger percentage of feedback you'd get would involve marine life because, really, you know, the sciencey trips that we take typically are going snorkeling and scuba diving and checking out fish. That's our definition of science in our family. So, you know, just want to, before we move on, the Hanford site, I wanted to ask you about when it was decommissioned. And I'm sure you learned some of the history around this.
Actually, the Hanford site was also written by Ashley Braun, and so I hadn't been involved in writing that.
Okay. Very interesting.
Lynn, you know what would be cool is to take the Key Largo piece, where, of course, includes the Everglades and all sorts of different things that you can do, and also somehow tag into that the Cape Kennedy, Cape Canaveral. And I don't know what sort of tours they have out there. I used to do business out in that area and was involved in this space shot with the CIA of this spy satellite. And the program director took me on this tour, and I went into the old mission, the old Gemini and Mercury mission control. I don't know if that's part of the tour, but for all the people that wanted to be aeronautical engineers, you know, the kids that wanted to be astronauts, that I would think, Lynn, that that'd be a cool thing to tag on to Largo.
I think so. I think you're giving Allie another idea. Turn it into a week-long tour.
Yeah, why not?
I definitely think that that's a road trip you could make. It's a couple of hours away, but it's definitely doable. And then you have so many jumping off points from there, and you can start around the Kennedy Space Center. You can keep going down to Key Largo, and they also have Key Deer down there, which are these really adorable little miniature deer. And there's just so many other places if you keep going down the Keys, too. There's Bahia Honda State Park and Key West. And then if you're really adventurous, you could go out to the Dry Tortugas.
All right.
Where was that again, Allie, the last place you mentioned?
Oh, the Dry Tortugas National Park.
Oh. Okay.
Allie, before we let you go, I have to ask you about an article you recently wrote about marine biologists doing work actually for the last about 15 years in the waters between Cuba and Florida. And there's a lot of collaboration, as it turns out, non-governmental, of course, between Cuban and U.S. scientists. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's actually surprising to hear that this has been one of the key areas of collaboration. For American scientists, it is difficult to do work in Cuba, and for Cuban scientists, it's difficult to do work in their home country because of the embargo. And in terms of getting research supplies down there, it's definitely an endeavor, and a lot of times they can't get the research supplies that they need. But because the water is this shared ecosystem and because they are so close, this has been one of the areas that scientists have really been teaming up, because there are no barriers, there are no fences in the ocean. And David Guggenheim, also known as the Ocean Doctor, has been doing research in Cuba for, I think, about 14 years now, and he's been a really key player in facilitating that collaboration.
Is there anything about marine life in Cuban waters? I mean, has it been fished to the same degree American waters have been fished, or is there something more pristine about waters there that give us greater insight into marine biology?
That's a great question. Cuban waters are actually very healthy. Cuba has some of the healthiest coral reefs in the Caribbean. And so part of Guggenheim's research and with his colleagues, they're looking at what makes this so special and why is it so healthy, because their largest underwater sanctuary, Gardens of the Queen, it used to be heavily fished, and then they decided to set it aside as a protected area. And it's really bounded back, and so there's a lot of lessons that the U.S. can learn from Cuban reefs. And Cuba has been very proactive in protecting their waterways. They've set aside a lot of their waters as protected areas, and they've banned bottom trawling, which is a very destructive fishing method. And they're really committed to a lot of environmental issues.
That's pretty heartening and interesting. I visited Cuba once and noticed that there are marine preserves all over the place. So wonderful. Well, Allie Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us today. It's interesting. Now we know where we can go. The closest one to where we live here in Park City, Utah is Boulder, Colorado, of course. And I, because we've had this conversation, will definitely stop by there when the next visit to Boulder. So thank you for that. And thanks for joining us.
That's great to hear. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care. Again, that was Allie Wilkinson. She's a freelance journalist for publications like Discover, Scientific American, Popular Science, and others. And I like that. Going on trips for the sake of science.
Yes.
Turning over a new leaf, John. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about octopuses.
Oof.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest, Frank Grasso, does research into the neural, ecological, and behavioral foundations of intelligence. He conducts closely paralleled animal and robotic studies to evaluate alternative explanations for the intelligent behavior of biological systems. Research in this interdisciplinary area contributes to our knowledge of biology, psychology, artificial intelligence, fluid mechanics, and robotics. It's quite a sentence, isn't it, Lynn?
You did well.
Thank you. Now, can an octopus give us insight into how to develop a robot? Well, Frank Grasso is joining us by phone to help us answer these questions. Frank, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello, John and Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great. Take a minute and tell us about your lab. You are the director of the Biomimetric and Cognitive Robotics Lab at Brooklyn College at SUNY New York. So tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, it's the Biomimetic and Cognitive Robotics Lab at the City University of New York, which is CUNY. But before I go on to that, can I give a shout-out to my extended family who live in Utah?
Absolutely.
Great. Hello, Kenny, Stephanie, JC, and Calliope. Yeah, that's a good one. Anyway,
What was the last name, Goliathy?
Calliope, one of the muses from ancient Greece, the muse of music. Yeah.
Whoa. Calliope.
So, you know, the old Calliope, the musical instrument, was actually named being inspired by this ancient Greek muse who was supposed to inspire people about music.
Hmm.
I don't think that has much to do with octopus, though.
That's
no,
okay.
I mean, probably doesn't, but let's keep going.
We have a lot of strange names here in Utah, but that's not one I've ever heard.
Well, so the Biomimetic and Cognitive Robotics Lab that I run involves studying animal behavior and their nervous systems to build models, understanding of how behavior is controlled and organized. And so we study the animals and we make guesses and then theories and we test them about what the brain is doing. And then we transform those things, those ideas, into mathematical formulae that we can put into the bodies of robots to try to control the robots. And the unique thing that we do here in the BCR lab is, not too unique, it's rare in the world. The unique thing we do is we use the animal behavior as a yardstick to judge whether or not our robots are doing things the right way, that the robot can handle the same behavior under the same conditions as the animal, then we've got a pretty good idea, or at least some confirmation, that our ideas about what the brain does in that particular animal is appropriate. So that's kind of the spirit of our lab.
Well, interesting. I think what a lot of our listeners are most interested in is the development of new technologies that would be inspired by these animal abilities. Can you tell us about actual things that have been developed as a result of studying animals?
Sure. One of the things that I first started out with was understanding how to track chemicals underwater or in air. I was part of a big national project, and what the applications for this are would be, for example, finding an unexploded mine underwater. A mine would be releasing chemicals into the water or into the air, and being able to track that through space to be able to find it would be a good thing to have a robot do. And I was working at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole with Yella Atima, who was an international lobster expert. And it was clear that lobsters were very, very good at tracking chemicals to their sources through turbulent water with their external antennae as a guide, actually their antennules. And so we developed algorithms that could be put into robots that would actually be comparably competent, although not quite as good, no, maybe not even half as good as a lobster, but much better than technology that we had at the time for being able to track chemicals underwater in turbulent conditions, which is quite a daunting problem.
You know, for people that have not heard of it or been out there, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute is just a spectacular area in the country.
Oh, I lived there for 7 years. It was really wonderful. But I was at the Marine Biological Lab, which is next door to the Woods Hole Oceanographic.
Right.
Yeah.
And ever have lunch at the kids?
Oh, my goodness. I tell you, I have an institution in my lab with my students and the visiting scientists called Beer at 5, and we would be there at 5 o'clock every Friday to have drinks and talk about the science right there at the Captain Kidd. Yeah,
absolutely.
You're taking me back.
Yeah. So that's in Cape Cod in Woods Hole right outside of Falmouth. It's just a beautiful area, and they do some great, great research there.
Yeah, it was a privilege and a pleasure to be there. So I moved my my laboratory to Brooklyn, where I am now, at the City University of New York. And I continued my lobster work, but then I also, if you'll pardon the pun, reached out to work on octopus arms. And we were working, again, with a large international team who were interested in developing octopus-inspired robots. And the cool thing about octopus is that, you know, I think I listened to a couple of your shows before in preparation for this, and I think one of the things that's really exciting about doing science is that it stretches your imagination, and it's great when you take what should be science fiction and you turn it into something that becomes real by just trying. And I tell you, the octopus arm and the octopus itself is exactly like science fiction if we think about how it's built and how it's controlled. They have no bones. The way that they're able to do things like being able to take the lid off of a jar, learn how to take a lid off of a jar, or even unscrew a jar lid, the way that they're able to do that is done completely with muscle acting against muscle. So this is a completely soft and reshapable structure that the animal has great control over and can do very, very fine manipulations of things and very, very forceful manipulations. So we started studying the arm, building on work that people had done before, and in particular, my work focused on the octopus suckers, which I could talk to you for hours about because they're fascinating, and transforming that into technology, a soft arm, which again didn't get to the level of capacity that the octopus has, but really made great progress in developing what you could consider the beginnings of a new technology. And yes, please go ahead.
So, Frank, I have to ask you, I mean, is it really as simple as one day you were just observing an octopus and you're noticing these arms that seem to operate very independently of each other, and they made you think about robots? Was it something like that? Or is it some other, you know, deeper knowledge that you had of octopus?
Yeah, it wasn't that simple, but it was much more pleasurable. It's much more like you look around the world and say, what is it that animals can do that we don't know how to do with our own technologies? And then you get a sense of wonder, and you say, how the heck are they doing that? And you begin asking those questions to understand how it is that the animal does it, because the animal is what we call an existence proof. If an animal like an octopus has a soft and completely flexible arm that it can precisely move into whatever positions it wants, it proves that physically that can be realized. And so that's exciting. That's why I said it's like science fiction. But it isn't a casual sort of thing where you say, oh, today I think I'll build an octopus robot. This took years of preparation and study of the robot and study of robotics and studies of animals. And as I said, I was part of a very large and distinguished team.
So because you are so enamored of these suction cups on the octopus appendages, tell us about that. I know a little bit about it and why it doesn't suction onto its own arms, which is fascinating. And then how, if at all, you've been able to translate that into a robot, because, wow, what a very functional, what a great function, suction.
Sure, sure. So I'll back up and talk a little bit about how octopus suckers work, because they're not like the children's dart gun toy that you point at the wall and it attaches. They're similar, but they have three components which make them a lot more sophisticated, more like fingers than sort of suction cups. So there are three parts. There's this sucker rim, which is this outer edge, and this is made, again, of muscle, which can reshape itself. So what happens is that this rim on the end of the sucker can be expanded and contracted pretty much anywhere it needs to so that it can form a tight seal on any kind of complicated surface. And so you form that tight seal, and then the animal forms that tight seal, and then there's an internal large muscle that takes that contained water inside of the now enclosed area, volume inside of the sucker. That muscle can expand powerfully enough to be able to break the water, actually take its molecular structure apart. It's called cavitation. So the animal is limited in the amount of force it can apply in terms of suction by how strong water is. And that's very, very strong, 2 atmospheres of pressure. Then, once it's attached with that rigorous grasp, there's a ring of muscles that connect the sucker to the arm that allow the animal to rotate it like on a universal joint. So if anything is attached to that sucker, they can move it back and forth and all around in 360 degrees. And if it's something that's larger than the octopus can use it to locomote and move itself along. And actually, it's amazing to watch the coordination of, 900 suckers or something on an animal all being coordinated to have it walk up a sheet of glass. It's one of the things we do in my laboratory a bit is to look at inter-sucker coordination. Anyway, the sucker is this really exquisite engineering device, and the animal can actually pick things up and pass them like a conveyor belt, small items back and forth down the length of the arm. And it's really an exquisite bit of engineering, and every bit of it has that sort of sensory motor control where the rim of the sucker reaches out to the surface, and it actually has to make decisions about whether or not it's conformed to the surface by touch. So the rim of that sucker contains a lot of touch sensors, so it knows when it's making contact. But to get forward to your question now, Lynn, it's also covered with chemical sensors. So when it makes contact with that surface and it makes a seal, not only is it telling that it's in mechanical contact, but it's tasting it. You can look at an octopus and see the 300 suckers down the arm and imagine it is almost like a tongue. The animal moving around the world and tasting everything it comes into contact. When imagine the human being with tongues on our feet, so that as we walk along on the floor of the building, we would never go bare feet, I imagine, be tasting all the things that are on the floor. But that's part of the octopus's experience of the world. So I think I could keep going, but maybe I can keep going to get to your point, but I know I've talked a lot.
Well, Frank, I'm curious about something. This is a little off the wall, but I mean, an octopus doesn't consciously say to itself, I think I'm going to pick up that baseball over there. I mean, they're just moving through the environment, and they have all these biosensors that dictate how they're going to pick something up or what they're going to do. I mean,
they're reactive versus proactive in a way.
Yeah. Can you talk to that at all, or am I in a completely crazy area?
Well, you're talking about one of the really big questions about cephalopods in general. And cephalopods are octopuses, cuttlefishes, and squids, and there also are these chambered nautilus, which are really interesting creatures. And they all have a common brain architecture. And that common brain architecture goes back 5.5 million years, long before there were mammals.
Right.
And yet, these guys have a brain that's about as complex as a mammal in terms of its organization. And these animals can do behaviors on a degree of complexity comparable to a mammal. So to get to your question, John, the idea here is that the stuff that I've been talking about is this complex peripheral nervous system. If you take an octopus arm and you cut it off, it's capable of all kinds of behaviors, coordinated behaviors, sophisticated behaviors, independent of the brain. And if you take an octopus and you produce what's called a decerebrate preparation, where you scoop out the brain, most of its behaviors, in fact, like being able to feed itself and locomote and all that kind of stuff, complicated behaviors, persist. But the top level of the octopus brain is an intensely complex learning and memory system that allows it, in the course of its short life, to be able to learn all kinds of complicated skills, like unscrewing a jar, which is a thing it probably wasn't prepared for evolutionarily. So that the question that you ask is, what does the octopus think? And the answer is, we don't know. But my answer is, it has a brain that's sophisticated enough and complicated enough levels of organization that it might be able to do something akin to what we might call thinking. But the organization of that brain is fundamentally different from our own. And this is, again, where we come to science fiction, that we can wonder how an animal might understand the world with a brain, a nervous system, and a body that are just so alien compared to ours.
Well, Frank, that's fascinating. And
hey, we have a new aquarium here in Salt Lake City, and it's making me wonder if they have an octopus.
We
must go down there.
Well, I would encourage all of your listeners to hurry there if they have an octopus and experience the wonder of what an octopus is, because once you see one, you'll be hooked as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope I get as hooked as you.
We are speaking with Frank Rosso, Director of Biomimetric and Cognitive Robotics Lab. Did I pronounce everything correctly?
It's actually the biomimetic.
Mimetic.
Biomimetic. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Copying biology.
All right, great. Well, listen, thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was fascinating. We will return after these messages, and then we have Chris Robinson up, and looking forward to speaking with him. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital that's part of the Intermountain Healthcare family. Healing from an orthopedic injury can be a difficult challenge, but our physical therapy team uses the most advanced tools to help you recover, like a SwimX therapy pool, which allows you to swim against a current or run on an underwater treadmill. Our state-of-the-art gym equipment addresses injury-specific cardio, strength, and balance therapies so you can return to work or play as quickly as possible. Learn more at parkcitymedicalcenter.org.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, our next guest you know is a Summit County Council member, but he's way more than that. He's a landowner, he's a conservationist, and he's someone who's intimately associated with the preservation and restoration of sage-grouse habitat and also June suckers. You could call it a hobby, but he's actually just won a distinguished award. It's the Division of Wildlife Resource Stewardship Award for Landowner of the Year for all of that conservation work around several of his properties. And Chris Robinson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Lynn. It's a pleasure.
Well, I have been wandering the countryside on a bicycle in an area where you have done some sage grouse. Would you call it habitat restoration, what exactly do you work on?
Well, one of the projects we're doing on our Rosebud Ranch in Box Elder County is to remove the pinyon juniper that has been allowed to overgrow, let's say. It's a climax species, so when fire is removed from an ecosystem, it tends to be the last thing you get. And the sage grouse avoid those areas because of raptor perches and also because there's not much in the understory below juniper. It has toxins in the needles, and it just tends to dominate. And so we've been working on the Rosebud Ranch to restore, to remove juniper and to allow and to reseed it with more favorable plants for sage grouse.
Right.
In part, we did that last summer and through the winter on an area that was also burned. We had a thing called the every fire is given a name. This one was called the Rocky Complex Fire, and we worked on our private land and on BLM land with other agencies in order to reclaim some of that land. And then we did a large area on our own.
Hmm.
And so that's, there's a lot of ways to, we're trying to restore the habitat, the more areas. This Rosebud Ranch is on the south end of the Grouse Creek Mountains, and it didn't get that name by mistake or by accident. There's a lot of sage grouse in northwestern Box Elder County.
Wait, where is Box Elder County?
Box Elder County is the northwestern county in the state. So Brigham City, Tremonton,
okay,
Snowville, Park
right.
Valley.
We know these places.
Honeyville.
When I first moved here 3 years ago, my buddy Robbie took me out to Hennifer, and we were watching sort of a mating ritual of the males when they puff out their chests and they're all strutting around and everything. And it kind of reminded me of a Saturday night at the No Name.
Yeah,
there's
a lot of testosterone being exhibited there. And
these were really good looking guys, and they had their shoulders back and their chests out, and they were strutting around the girls, and it was really it's fascinating.
Yeah, no, it is. There's a really good lek, and it's maybe the one that you saw that's kind of it's just this side of Hennifer, and you go up that pass, and there's an area that kind of a little pull-off area, and there's some signage there. And in late March, you can see them there almost every morning. You have to get there like at 6 or 7 in the morning.
Yeah, we were there pretty early. How did you get interested in the sage grouse?
Well, when you're interested in land, you know everything that comes with it, you get interested in.
Yeah,
we're in the resource management business, my day job, and so we have a lot of these landscapes that have wildlife resource values, and nearly everything that we own in northern Utah is sage grouse habitat. And so whether we like it or not, we're in the business of worrying about and caring for sage grouse.
Well, it's interesting to me. I think the sage grouse is one of the most revered birds, and maybe it's because in Utah is where most sage grouse are found, maybe more than any other state. I know it's the general in the West, right?
I don't think that's accurate. I think in the Rocky Mountain states, the sage grouse has... It ranges from, Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, Utah, and so forth, Oregon. And I think that we have actually a smaller percentage of the habitat. We may have 10 or 15% or something, but, you think about all the slick rock and the southern Utah-type country that's not habitat. And by the way, when we're talking sage grouse, we're talking the greater sage grouse as opposed to the Gunnison sage grouse. And there are other species, but generically when we say sage grouse in this context, it's the greater sage grouse. And so it's really northern Utah, northwestern, northeastern Utah. It's not in a big share of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Wyoming, Wyoming has maybe a huge percentage of its area that's
right,
habitat.
Right. What can you tell us about this recent lawsuit a couple environmental groups are bringing against an operation, I think it's called Berry Petroleum, and they're proposing to drill like 400 new wells in the Uinta Basin, which is sort of hard to believe until you go out there and you see how many wells have been drilled out there for oil, and it threatens the sage-grouse habitat out there. What do you know about that case?
Well, I don't know a lot about that in specific, but in general, if you look at a map, it looks like someone took a shotgun to a paper target as far as the spacing on oil and gas development in parts of the Uinta Basin. And I think that these new wells are on federal lands. And I believe in balance. And I think, it's like there are some things that where we want to farm, or some places we want to build homes, and some places we want to preserve. And I wonder in some instances whether, and I don't know the specifics of where this is in Uinta Basin, but I wonder if the horse is out of the barn there in some ways, and that parts of it maybe need to be a sacrifice area because it's already riddled, finding that balance. I don't know the specifics though. I mean, if it's in some iconic place that has other values that are being compromised, but a lot of that country is pretty bleak in other regards.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeremy Nichols, who's the Wild Earth Energy Program Director, this is a quote: "The oil and gas industry is turning public lands in this region into an industrial wasteland." And according to one of these other articles we took a peek at, they said that when the Mormon pioneers crossed the prairie years ago, there was an estimated 16 million greater sage grouse in the West, and the population is down to about 10% of those original levels.
Yeah, something like that. It's way low. It's like let me just give you a little history on my involvement with this. So in 2010, the Fish and Wildlife Service issued a ruling that said protecting the greater sage grouse was warranted for listing but precluded from listing as an endangered species. Okay, so what that means is that, yes, the threats were there, but that because of other priorities, they were precluded from listing. The agency didn't have enough horsepower to list it. So they said, we're going to review it in 5 years, which comes up again in September of 2015. And so what that caused a lot of people to do, mostly state governments in the West, to say, we want to do all we can to avoid listing it. And so they went out and came up with management plans. And so the state of Utah came up with a sage-grouse management plan and identified maybe a dozen management areas. And one of them is the Uinta Basin, but there are lots of others. The biggest one is Morgan Summit Ridge County, which has, like more males strutting on the leks than any other over a 10-year average. And anyway, so the point I'm trying to make is that an effort's being made to avoid listing, and it may not be that we can protect every area. There may be some areas that are too far gone. I'm not saying that the Uinta Basin should be written off. I'm just saying that I'm not sure we can protect everywhere.
Right.
Okay. Well, very interesting. And if we had more time, I'd want to get into how the sage grouse adapts when its habitat is ruined. But maybe that's for another conversation.
I'm afraid so.
Chris Robinson is the recipient of the Division of Wildlife Resources Stewardship Award for Landowner of the Year. Congratulations to you.
Thanks, Lynn.
And thanks for joining us today.